Chapter 11. Pretexts and Processions. I reached Gang Tok late in the evening, when darkness had long since fallen. The journey from Kalimpong had taken much longer than I expected, and when the Land Rover set me down at the motor stand, only a few dimly lit shops and stores were still open, and the centre of the village capital, as it was called, wore a strangely deserted and desolate look. Engaging a coolie to carry my bedding roll, I somehow made him understand that I wanted to be taken straight to the Royal Palace, and after a short delay we set off together in what I hoped was the right direction. The sacred relics were, I knew, being kept at the palace temple, and the palace seemed to be the most likely place in which to find Venerable Sangharatana and the other members of the delegation. After the coolie and I had plodded on in silence for half an hour, the path suddenly became very steep, and soon we were climbing up what seemed to be the hillside. Moreover, it was pitch dark. Surely there must be some mistake. We did not seem to be getting any nearer to the royal palace. Indeed, all buildings had long since been left behind. The coolie, however, seemed quite confident that we were going in the right direction, and I had no alternative but to follow in his footsteps, forcing my way between bushes and stumbling over the rough ground. Eventually we emerged into the open, and I found myself on the edge of a sort of plateau, with the dark mass of a building standing silhouetted against the night sky only a few dozen yards away. From a pair of French windows in the centre of the mass streamed a brilliant light, and towards the little light I made my way. Before I could reach it, however, I was intercepted by an astonishing figure in red and black and white, who carried a rifle and wore a pink hat with feathers in it. This was one of the soldiers of the Royal Bodyguard, and his uniform was based on what I was afterwards told was traditional Lepcha dress. Taking me round to a veranda at the front of the building, he called an aide-de-camp, and the aide-de-camp called the Crown Prince. The sacred relics were indeed being kept at the palace temple, the Crown Prince explained, but the delegation was staying at the state guest house. He would drive me there in the jeep immediately. A few minutes later, therefore, we were speeding down a series of hairpin bends, which the Crown Prince, judging by the speed and the skill with which he negotiated them, knew very well indeed. Though short, the journey gave us an opportunity of becoming better acquainted, and not having met the Crown Prince before, I scrutinised the figure at the wheel with considerable interest. He was dressed in an off-white tuba, and whenever he turned his head to speak to me, I saw an intelligent-looking Mongolian face in which there twinkled a pair of beady black eyes. The most noticeable thing about the Crown Prince, unfortunately, was his stutter, which was so pronounced that he at times had to struggle for half a minute or so before he was finally able, with a tremendous effort, to ejaculate the word that was giving him trouble. Having arrived safely at the state guest house, which was a small bungalow situated on the hillside within a leisurely bend of the road, I found Venerable Sangharatana and the other members of the delegation clustered round the English-style fireplace in one of the bedrooms and warming themselves at the blaze, the first of its kind I had seen for several years. Accustomed as they were to the sweltering heat of the plains, both Venerable Sangharatana and Kashyapji were feeling the cold quite badly, and despite their balaclava helmets and woollen jerseys, were still shivering violently. Dr. Madhuran Soft, whom I had not met before, apparently felt the cold much less than his two yellow-robed companions. He was a very tall, hardy Punjabi of about 60, clad in the white homespun garments, in his case loose-fitting trousers and long Indian overshirt, that betokened the orthodox Gandhian believer. Head and face alike were covered with a white stubble, while his toothless gums were parted in a smile of genuine warmth and friendliness that contrasted strangely with the rather angry expression in his eyes. As I was to learn when I knew him better, Dr. Soft was a very kindly man indeed. But he was also, by his own oft-repeated confession, the possessor of a truly vile temper that he was at times quite unable to control. Also clustered round the fireplace were the three assistants to the delegation. These were Brahmachari Munindra, the young Bengali Buddhist in whose company Buddha Rakshita and I had travelled from Nautanwa to Lumbini only 2 years previously; Tashi Dorji, a young Darjeeling-born Tibetan who had formerly worked in the Mahabodhi Society's Calcutta office; and Geshe Sangpo, a graduate from one of the great monastic universities of Lhasa. By birth, the Geshe, or Doctor of Buddhist Divinity, was a native not of Tibet, but of Mongolia, which was said to produce the greatest scholars in the whole Gelugpa Buddhist world. How great a scholar Geshe Sangpo was, I had no means of telling, but I noticed that he was never without a big Tibetan xylograph volume in his hands, and usually sat cross-legged on the bed reading while the rest of us talked. As soon as greetings had been exchanged and the bearer ordered to bring more tea, Venerable Sangratana told me the latest news from Sarnath, as well as all about the reception that had been given the sacred relics on their arrival in Gangtok earlier in the day. As a matter of fact, he explained in his usual enthusiastic, incitable manner, they had brought with them not two, but three sets of relics. After all, they were going to Tibet to meet the Dalai Lama, and they might as well do the thing properly. Besides the relics of the two arhants, they had brought with them, in a brand new reliquary, some very authentic relics of the Lord Buddha, which had been presented to the Mulagandaguti Vihara some years ago. He was sure the Dalai Lama would be delighted, though he was rather young. Did he know anything about Buddhism? Anyway, the people of Sikkim were certainly delighted. At Bagdogra, where the plane had arrived 2 hours late, the relics had been received by the Crown Prince, and in Gangtok they had been received at the Palace Temple by the Maharaja. In between there had been a grand procession. Thousands of people had taken part. It had been a very busy day. Probably tomorrow would be even busier. By the way, was the Maharaja quite right in the head? Instead of greeting him in the usual manner with folded hands, he, the Maharaja, had taken both his, Sangharatana's, hands in his own, and had asked in a confidential undertone, "Do you want a woman?" As he told me the story, Venerable Sangharatana laughed uproariously. Like most Sinhalese monks, he was by no means prudish, and was inclined to treat the whole thing very much as a joke. For my part, I knew that a mystery of some kind surrounded the person of the Maharaja of Sikkim. According to one account, he was a mystic of an advanced type who spent most of his time in meditation. According to another, he was an alcoholic. Whatever the truth may have been, he in fact led the life of a recluse, appearing in public only on the most important occasions. One such occasion was that of the first public exposition of the sacred relics, which took place the following morning in the palace Lakang, or temple. This was not a mere chapel within the palace, as I had thought, thinking perhaps of Rani Dorji's chapel at Bhutan House, but a very new, very square, dazzlingly white, yellow-roofed building of traditional Sikkimese type that stood at the opposite end of the ridge from the palace, which, I could now see, was a medium-sized country house built after the English pattern. More than that, I did not have time to observe. With Sangharatana and Kashyapji, I was ushered up the narrow staircase and into the first-floor chamber, in which the sacred relics, both those of the two arahants and those of the Buddha, were being kept. Here, too, the impression was one of light and colour. Crimson pillars with elaborately carved and painted capitals supported the roof, while the walls were covered with frescoes of the most brilliant hues. At the far end of the chamber, the enormous golden figures of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas gleamed from behind panes of glass. The reliquaries containing these sacred relics were placed on a kind of throne that stood immediately in front of the central image, leaving only a little gangway behind. The silver gilt reliquary containing the remains of Shariputra and Moggallana was the more interesting of the two. It had been presented by the Buddhists of Ceylon and was a replica of the stupa in which the sacred relics of the Buddha's two chief disciples had been found by General Cunningham. After the three of us had chanted the refuges and precepts in Pali, followed by some verses of blessing, Venerable Sangharasana took out two small keys and proceeded to open the reliquaries and remove the lids. The lids of the reliquary containing the sacred relics of the two arahants was modelled after the dome, harmika and umbrella spire of the stupa, while its base, which was about 16 inches in diameter, was modelled after the stupa's railed circular plinth. On the raised middle portion of this base were the two steatite boxes in which the sacred relics had originally been found, and two golden lotuses, the boxes being situated to the north and south, and lotuses to the east and west. On the lotuses stood two gold-rimmed glass capsules, circular in shape. These capsules were about half an inch thick and about 2 inches in diameter, and each was attached to its lotus by a little golden ball. The greyish crumbs of bone on which all this artistry had been lavished, and which the government and people of Sikkim were receiving with so much enthusiasm, lay at the bottom of the capsules, all that was left, humanly speaking, of the two lifelong friends who had been the Buddha's chief disciples. By the time we had finished arranging the opened reliquaries on their brocade cushions, the chamber was full and presented a more colourful appearance than ever. Sikkim, being a Buddhist kingdom, and its ruler not an ordinary Maharaja, but a Chogyal or Dhammaraja, that is to say, a righteous monarch. The first exposition of the sacred relics was being attended not only by the reclusive Maharaja, but also by the royal family, the royal court, and members of the clergy and nobility, all resplendent in traditional costume. Since for the laity this costume was the chuba, long-sleeved for men, sleeveless for women, and since on occasions like this the chuba had to be made of Chinese silk brocade, the 200 or 300 people ranged on the right-hand side of the throne supporting the sacred relics and down the side of the chamber were an unforgettable sight. There were chubas of every imaginable hue, magenta, bottle green, chocolate brown, orange, peacock blue, royal purple and violet, all shimmering and glittering in the sunlight that streamed in through the lattices of the big square windows. There were ruby tubers, sapphire tubers, amethyst tubers. There were even tubers of silver and tubers of gold. Amidst all this magnificence, it was easy to forget that Sikkim was a country a third of the size of Wales, that its capital, Gangtok, contained 2,000 souls, and that its entire population numbered less than 150,000. After the Maharaja and his entourage had paid their respects to the sacred relics by prostrating themselves and offering one by one the usual silk kata, or ceremonial white scarf, the doors of the palace temple were opened to the public, and for the next few hours, Sangharatana, Kashyapji and I were kept very busy indeed. In front of the sacred relics passed a stream of people, all desirous of paying homage to the Buddha and his two chief disciples. Besides the Sikkimese themselves, who in any case were of quite mixed descent, there were Tibetans, Bhutanese and Nepalese, all in their distinctive national costumes. There were even a few Indians, mainly Mowaris and Punjabis. Most of the worshippers were content simply to press their foreheads to the edge of the throne on which the two reliquaries had been placed, offer their silk or cotton cutter, together with some money, and then pass on. The more orthodox, or the more devout, retreated a few paces from the throne in order to make a triple prostration, after which they would insist on having the reliquary containing the remains of Shariputra and Modgalyayana, which was the larger of the two, lifted up and placed on the top of their heads by way of a blessing. Followers of Tibetan Buddhism, it seemed, attached great importance to actual physical contact with sacred objects. Every few minutes, therefore, Sangharatana and I, who were stationed on either side of the throne, Kashyapji found it difficult to remain standing for very long, had to grasp the base of the reliquary firmly in both hands and then, between us, lift it up a few inches before gently lowering it onto the bowed head of the devotee, who would receive the blessing with hands resting on the edge of the throne and tongue respectfully protruded. Whenever there were a number of such worshippers in quick succession, this process of raising and lowering the reliquary was apt to degenerate into the administration of a series of rapid bumps on the bowed heads that appeared in front of us. Sometimes, for one reason or another, the bump would be quite a hard one, whereupon Sangharatana would laugh heartily. As for the recipient of the bump, from the pleased expression with which he or she looked up at us afterwards, it was clear that they were only too happy to be blessed in this emphatic and unmistakable manner. When not actually attending to the needs of the worshippers, Sangharatana and I had to keep clearing away the katas that had been laid along the edge of the throne, immediately in front of the sacred relics, since otherwise the two reliquaries would have been completely buried beneath them. We were helped in this task not only by Dr. Soft, but also by a jovial young Sikkimese nobleman in a blue brocade tuba, who had been dashing about the chamber taking a large number of photographs with a whole battery of expensive-looking cameras. This was Tseten Tashi, the Maharaja's good-natured and obliging private secretary, with whom we very quickly made friends, and who lost no time in telling us that his two great passions were photography and orchids. In fact, he had a photographic studio in the bazaar, he proudly informed us, and also ran an orchid nursery as a sideline. If our reverences wanted our photographs taken before leaving Gangtok, or if we wanted a few orchids for our friends, then Tseten Tashi was at our service. From the comical way in which he said this, it was clear that he did not really expect us, as monks, to take his offer very seriously. But if he did not really expect to be of service to us where photographs and orchids were concerned, he was certainly of great service to us there in the chamber. Indeed, he stayed with us until the last worshippers of the day had passed in front of these sacred relics and helped us to clear up afterwards. He tied up the katas into great bundles, swept the coins and currency notes into bags, and gathered up the pieces of jewellery that had been offered by some of the women worshippers, all the time keeping up a cheerful commentary on the events of the day. In the evening, Kashyapji and I delivered discourses in the spacious music room adjoining the palace temple. Why it was called the music room was not clear, since there was no sign of any musical instruments, whether Eastern or Western, or indeed of any arrangements for the playing of music. Perhaps the lamas attached to the temple used the place for practicing on their drums and trumpets, or perhaps a Western-style concert had once been held there. In any case, it was surely not without significance that, whereas there should be a palace Lakhang, or House of Divinities, of the utmost magnificence for the ritual worship of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, there should be no corresponding provision for the teaching of the Dharma, that is to say, no proper Dharma hall. If this state of affairs was at all representative of the conditions in the kingdom as a whole, it would seem to indicate a serious imbalance in contemporary Sikkimese Buddhism. Though I did not know it at the time, such an imbalance between faith and wisdom did in fact exist, and as Thubten Tenzing, who knew Sikkim well, pointed out in an article he wrote for the special Sikkim number of Stepping Stones that I brought out 2 months later. Quote, on the negative side of the balance sheet, it must be said that the strictly intellectual element in the tradition, that of doctrine, both in its more theoretical form and as actualized by method and experience, has largely disappeared from Sikkim, and this is a matter for very serious misgiving, since the loss affects the most essential element of all, knowledge, starting point and final term of all spiritual endeavour. End of quote. It was also significant that, whereas in the course of the day several thousand people had paid their respects to the sacred relics, only a few dozen people turned up to hear Kashyapji and myself deliver our discourses. For the most part, these belonged to the Western-educated minority and included a number of Hindus. As for the Maharaja and his court, on this occasion they were conspicuous by their absence, though the Crown Prince was there and followed the discourses with close attention. For the remainder of the week that the sacred relics were in Gangtok, the days passed in much the same way that the first one had done. In the morning and afternoon, Sangharatana, Dr. Soft and I, assisted more often than not by the ebullient Tsetin Tashi, watched over the sacred relics in the upstairs chamber of the palace temple, and attended to the needs of the worshippers, many of whom had come on foot from distant parts of Sikkim and Bhutan. In the evening, Kashyapji and I delivered our discourses in the music room. By the end of the seventh day of the exposition, 10,000 people, it was estimated, had paid their respects to the sacred relics, and Sangharatana and I had blessed and bumped at least one-third of that number on their respectfully bowed heads with the silver gilt reliquary. It was noticeable, though, that as the week went by, the stream of people slowly abated, and that whereas on the first day of the exposition several thousand worshippers had passed through the upper chamber of the palace temple, on the last day there were fewer than 1,000. In the case of the evening discourses, however, exactly the opposite happened. Day by day our little audience steadily grew, with the result that by the end of the week it numbered nearly 100. Younger Sikkimese Buddhists in particular responded to the discourses with great enthusiasm. They had no idea, they declared, that Buddhism taught such wonderful things. Since Kashyapji and I had been discoursing mainly on such basic topics as the Four Noble Truths and the Noble Eightfold Path, this was rather surprising and constituted further evidence of the disastrous decline in respect of doctrinal knowledge that had overtaken Sikkimese Buddhism in recent years. Clearly there was an urgent need for a revival of Buddhism throughout the entire kingdom, and perhaps the YMBA could be of some help in this connection. Since Sangharatana, Dr. Soft and I spent so much of our time together, Kashyapji was generally absent on business of his own, it was inevitable that the three of us should become better acquainted day by day, especially as both of my fellow delegates, Sangharatana particularly, were of a warm-hearted and communicative disposition. Dr. Soft was never tired of telling Sangharatana and myself how, only a few weeks earlier, he had accompanied the sacred relics to Ladakh, where they had had to struggle through the snow with their precious burden from one remote monastery to another. What a reception the people of Ladakh had given them! How devout they were! As the old man reminisced, his face lit up and his eyes filled with tears. To have witnessed such devotion, he declared, was one of the greatest experiences of his life. Sangharatana, for his part, had quite a lot to say about how, a few months previously, he had accompanied the sacred relics to Burma, where they had been received by the Prime Minister, Yu Nu, and taken for exposition to many different parts of the country. The Burmese Buddhists, too, were very devout, much more devout than the Sinhalese. In fact, until he came to Sikkim, He had never seen such devotion as he saw in Burma. The faith of the Burmese Buddhists was so strong it could even work miracles. In one of the places to which the sacred relics had been taken, a small town in the interior, I think he said it was, he himself had actually seen with his own eyes the tiny fragments of bone rotating in a clockwise direction within their respective capsules, while there emanated from them a brilliant rainbow-coloured light. 2,000 people had been present and had seen the miracle, if it really was a miracle, he added with a laugh. That is to say, 2,000 people had seen the rainbow-coloured light, and several hundred, including himself and the other members of the delegation, had seen the sacred relics rotating within their capsules. No doubt it was all due to the especially intense devotion with which the Burmese Buddhists had been worshipping the sacred relics on that occasion. Though Venerable Sangharatana was a man of fervently devotional temperament, he was also truthful and outspoken to an unusual degree, and I therefore saw no reason to question the complete accuracy of his account. According to the Theravada tradition, miracles of the kind he had described could be produced in three different ways. They could be produced as a result of an exercise of iddhi, or siddhi, or supernormal power, especially by a Buddha or an Arahant. Secondly, they could be produced by the intervention of the devas or gods. And thirdly, they could be produced by the faith of the worshipper. Since neither the Buddha nor presumably any Arahant had been present on the occasion, and since no one had seen any devas, not that they might not have been invisibly present, it seemed wisest to assume, with Sangharatana, that the miracle had been produced as a result of the collective faith of the worshippers, who were undeniably present in large numbers, and apparently deeply moved by the presence among them of the actual bodily remains of the Buddha's two chief disciples. But although all this was quite clear to me, I was not so clear about my own personal attitude towards these sacred relics, which was in fact rather ambivalent. I was deeply touched by the simple faith and unaffected piety of the people who every day came to pay their respects to the sacred relics, and I could even empathise with that faith and that piety. But at the same time, I was quite unable to feel towards the sacred relics the kind of devotion that they so evidently felt. For one thing, I was not even sure that the tiny fragments of bone lying at the bottom of the capsules really had belonged to Shariputra and Moggallana. True, they had been discovered by General Cunningham at Stupa No. 3 at Sanchin, and there seemed no reason to doubt that the inscriptions on the steatite boxes in which he had found them were in Brahmini characters of the time of Ashoka. But how could one be sure that these same fragments of bone really were the relics of the two Arahants, as the builders of the stupa apparently believed? Between the time of Shariputra and Moggallana, who had predeceased the Buddha, and the time of Ashoka, there was an interval of more than 200 years, and there was no record of the whereabouts of the relics of the two great disciples, if indeed relics there ever were, during that period. I had to admit to myself that although the relics might be those of Shariputra and Moggallana, and although the idea that I might possibly be in contact with a portion of their actual bodily remains did give me a more vivid sense of their actual historical existence, the sight of the tiny fragments of bone lying at the bottom of the capsules was far from making me feel, as judging by their rapt expressions many of the worshippers felt, that I was in the actual living presence of the two Arahants. For me, the principal value of the exposition consisted in the fact that it was a means of awakening in the hearts of thousands of people devotional feelings which could, if properly challenged, eventually be directed to the actual study and practice of the Buddha's teaching. That was why I'd been so eager to invite the sacred relics to Kalimpong. That was why I had joined Sangharatana and Kashyapji in Gangtok. And it was one of the reasons why I was going to accompany them to Tibet. Arrangements for our departure had been going on all the week. The two officials of the Tibetan government who were to act as our escort had arrived some time previously, and with their help the delegation had been provided with warm clothing, a sufficient number of mules, and a palanquin for the conveyance of the sacred relics. We were to set out at the beginning of March, only 2 days after the end of the week-long exposition of the sacred relics in the palace temple. Almost on the eve of our departure, however, an unexpected setback occurred, at least as far as I was concerned. Word reached us that the government of India was refusing to allow me to cross the frontier between Sikkim and Tibet. In my excitement at the prospect of visiting the land of snows, I had either forgotten that there were such things as frontier permits, or had assumed that they were only a formality. I soon discovered my mistake. When I went to see the political officer, as the government of India's representative in Sikkim was called, he told me that he had received definite instructions from Delhi not to allow me to enter Tibet by way of Sikkim, and was therefore unable to issue the necessary permit. The three other members of the delegation who had accompanied me to the political officer's residence all protested vigorously, saying that I was a Buddhist monk, that I would be going to Tibet as the guest of the Tibetan government, which had already granted me a visa, and that my mission was of a purely religious nature. All this was, of course, perfectly true. It was also true, as my companions thought it advisable not to point out, that the Sikkimese authorities, who one would have thought were the ones most directly concerned, had no objection whatever to my entering Tibet from Sikkim. But in matters of this sort, the truth did not, it seemed, carry much weight. Nothing that Dr. Soft or Sangharatana or Kashyapji could say was of any avail, and Mr. Dayal, the political officer, continued to insist that he was unable to issue me with the permit. Their repeated protests and expostulations did, however, have the effect of embarrassing him, at least in his personal capacity. Having heard some of my discourses and apparently not wanting me to think that he was acting on his own initiative, instead of simply obeying orders, he therefore took me aside and showed me a letter he had received from the Ministry of External Affairs. The letter was to the effect that I was not to be given a permit. Apparently the political officer had referred the matter to Delhi, and that foreign nationals were not to be allowed to cross the border between Sikkim and Tibet on any pretext. It was signed Jawaharlal Nehru. That, of course, settled the matter. Dr. Soft, who was the official leader of the delegation to Tibet, thanked the political officer for seeing us, and we all parted on friendly terms. It was now quite clear that I would not be able to accompany the sacred relics to Tibet, and quite clear that the decision not to give me the necessary permit had been taken at the very highest level, and for purely political reasons. Though I did not understand the situation very well at that time, I knew that the Chinese armies that had invaded Tibet the previous autumn were preparing to march on Lhasa, and that on the advice of his ministers, the Dalai Lama had withdrawn to Yatung so as to be out of harm's way in the event of any fighting. It was therefore conceivable that if the delegation accompanying the sacred relics happened to include an English Buddhist monk, the Chinese might take the view that the supposed Buddhist monk was in reality a British agent sent to establish secret contact with the Dalai Lama. It was also conceivable that they might regard it as an unfriendly act on the part of the government of India to have allowed a British agent disguised as a Buddhist monk to enter Tibet via Sikkim, which was an Indian protectorate, and to risk upsetting the Chinese was almost the last thing that Nehru and his pro-Chinese advisers wanted to do. Though the heady days of Hindi-Chini bye-bye, or Indians and Chinese are pals, were yet to come, India seemed intent on preserving good relations with communist China at almost any cost. After feeble initial protests, it had come to acquiesce in the Chinese occupation of Tibet, and only a few weeks earlier had actually allowed the Chinese general who had been placed in command in Tibet to travel to Lhasa via Calcutta, Kalimpong and Gangtok. No wonder I did not get my permit. If the government of India was willing to sacrifice the freedom and independence of Tibet on the altar of Sino-Indian friendship, it was unlikely that it would hesitate to make a similar sacrifice of my own chance of accompanying the sacred relics to Tibet. Having swallowed so enormous a camel, it could hardly be expected to strain at a gnat. Naturally, it was a great disappointment to me that I would not, after all, be able to visit the Land of Snows, especially as I knew that I might well not have the opportunity again. But disappointment was not the only emotion I felt on leaving the political officer's residence. I was also extremely annoyed by the implied suggestion in Pandit Nehru's letter that my reasons for visiting Tibet might not be what they seemed, and that, consequently, I myself might not be what I seemed. Foreign nationals, the political officer had been told, were not to be allowed to cross the border on any pretext. Was the fact that I wanted to accompany the sacred relics to Tibet officially regarded as a pretext, then? And if so, a pretext for what? Apparently it was conceivable that if the delegation happened to include an English Buddhist monk, the Indians, no less than the Chinese, might take the view that the supposed Buddhist monk was in reality a British agent. Indeed, in the case of the Indians, it seemed more than conceivable, for had I not been refused a permit, and had not Pandit Nehru's letter spoken of pretexts for crossing the border? It was, of course, possible that I was attaching too much significance to a single word or a single phrase. On any pretext might well mean no more than on any grounds or for any reason. Nonetheless, I could not quite dispel the suspicion that the word pretext had been used quite deliberately and reflected the government of India's inability to imagine that a foreigner could possibly have settled in a sensitive border area for purely religious reasons. My annoyance at what I took to be a slur on my good faith therefore lasted considerably longer than my disappointment at not being able to visit Tibet. At the time, however, I put these and all other personal feelings aside, and with the rest of the population of Gangtok, prepared to give these sacred relics and the delegation a fitting send-off on their departure for Tibet. Since it would take them 4 days to reach Yatung, and another day to reach the Dongkara Gompa, or White Conch Shell Monastery, where the Dalai Lama was staying, they set out early. The day was cold but clear, and the morning sun shone down brightly from a sky of cloudless blue on a picturesque and colourful scene as the sacred relics, after being deposited in a yellow-curtained palanquin provided by the Tibetan government, were carried in procession as far as the outskirts of the town. First in single file walked the lamas, some in magnificent ceremonial robes, some bearing the enormous, multicoloured, many-flounced cylinders known as banners of victory, and some bearing giant Tibetan trumpets, whose deep and mournful notes seemed to express, if I was not being too fanciful, the sorrow of the people at the departure of these sacred relics. Next came the yellow-curtained palanquin, borne on the shoulders of 6 bearers, on either side of which walked the Maharaja and the Crown Prince, members of the royal family, nobles, officials, and delegates. In the rear followed the guard of honour provided by the Sikkim State Police Force and members of the public. On reaching the huge Mani Wall, or wall painted with the mantra Om Mani Padme Hum, in the 6 traditional colours, which marked the beginning of the road to Tibet, the delegation mounted their ponies, the palanquin was shouldered by a fresh party of bearers, and amid shouts of farewell, the sacred relics slowly disappeared up the winding mountain trail that led to Yatung. Once again, I was left standing at the side of the road, and though this time I was not alone, I felt the departure of Sangharatana, Kashyapji, and Dr. Soft for Yatung no less keenly than I had felt Kashyapji's departure for Siliguri exactly a year ago. This time there were no parting words of admonition ringing in my ears. I knew what I had to do. After standing there beside the huge Maniwar for a few minutes wrapped in thought, I turned round and, with the help of a lift from the Crown Prince, was soon back at the state guest house. There I made arrangements to return to Kalimpong the same day. I had been away for a little more than a week, instead of for a month as I had expected, and Burma Raja and the rest of my friends would be surprised to see me, and surprised to learn that I had not been able to accompany the sacred relics to Tibet. But not being able to accompany the sacred relics to Tibet was not the only disappointment that I suffered in Gangtok. I also suffered a disappointment of a more strictly personal nature, and it was in connection with Kashyapji. Quite apart from the prospect of visiting the Land of Snows, one of the reasons why I had welcomed Sangharatana's invitation to join the delegation in Gangtok was that this would give me an opportunity of telling Kashyapji, indeed of complaining to him, about the way in which I had been treated by Aniruddha. Since our days were taken up with looking after these sacred relics and our evenings with delivering discourses, and since Kashyapji was often absent on business of his own, it was not very easy for me to find a suitable occasion on which to speak to my teacher. And it was only towards the end of the week that I was able to unburden myself of the feelings of distress and indignation that had weighed on me since my enforced departure from the Dhammodiya Vihara. Feelings which until then I had kept to myself. Or rather, it was only towards the end of the week that I was able to begin to unburden myself. Unburden myself fully, I could not. After a few minutes, Kashyapji cut me short and abjured me in the strongest terms not to feel any ill will towards Aniruddha and to forget all about the matter. We were bhikshus, he said, and it was our duty to put up with ill treatment without complaining. This was, of course, sound doctrine, and it was no doubt right and proper that he should remind me that, in the words of the Dhammapada verses we had studied together, hatred did not cease by hatred, but only by love. But what if one bhikshu ill-treated another? What if the ill-treatment came not from a hostile king or an unsympathetic householder, but from a fellow member of the monastic community, from whom one was entitled to expect sympathy, support, and encouragement, especially if one was very much the junior of the two? This aspect of the matter Kashyapji absolutely refused to consider, and would not even allow me to talk about it. He even refused to consider the possibility that Aniruddha had acted wrongly in any way. All he would say was that I should forgive and forget. While I agreed wholeheartedly that I should forgive, however difficult I might still find it to do this, I was by no means convinced that it was possible or even desirable for one to overlook the way in which one had been treated by another monk, or for one's teacher to overlook it. Though I did not have as clear an understanding of the nature of the Buddhist spiritual community as I had later, it was obvious to me that disharmony within the Sangha was a serious matter and could not be ignored, regardless of who was and who was not at fault. Kashyapji's attitude seemed to suggest that there was, in fact, no effective spiritual community, and that if you were ill-treated by another monk, you should simply keep out of his way, being only careful not to feel ill will towards him. The second disappointment I suffered in Gangtok was therefore due not so much to Kashyapji's lack of sympathy for the way in which I had been treated by Aniruddha, though I felt that too, as to his apparent failure to understand the emotional shock I had experienced On discovering that the monastic order was not the kind of spiritual brotherhood that I had been led to suppose. This original disappointment, the disappointment I experienced in connection with Kashyapji, only served to compound. It was as though Kashyapji accepted the lack of a Buddhist spiritual community, at least so far as the Theravada tradition was concerned, and believed that one should simply keep one's own nose clean. If that was really the case, I was even more alone than I had thought. Thinking things over in the Land Rover on the way back to Kalimpong, I remembered a conversation that had taken place between Kashyapji, Sangharatana, and Brahmachari Munindra one day in the jeep that was taking us from the state guest house up to the palace temple. A conversation that perhaps threw some light on Kashyapji's attitude towards disharmony in the Sangha. The three of them were discussing a serious breach of the Vinaya, or monastic code, of which an elderly and highly respected bhikshu had recently been guilty, and about which nothing, apparently, was going to be done. The breach was so serious, nothing less than making one of his female disciples pregnant, that I could not help asking Kashyapji, in some astonishment, "But is the story really true?" In tones of great sadness, Kashyapji had replied, "Yes, it's true. I'm afraid our old friend is no better than the rest of them." Since the rest of them were the other Theravada Buddhist monks in India, I could not help wondering whether my teacher had not suffered disappointments of his own in connection with the monastic order. I already knew that the Mahabodhi Society bhikshus at Sarnath were extremely jealous of him, and that, with the exception of Sangharatana, they spoke disparagingly of him behind his back, even though none of them had a hundredth part of his learning or generosity of spirit. But while he never referred to the jealousy of the Sarnath bhikshus, Kashyapji must have been well aware of it, and it was highly unlikely that their constant disparagement of him was the only unkindness he had had to put up with from his brother monks, or the least. Indeed, the more I thought about the matter, the more likely it seemed that Kashyapji had had quite a lot to put up with from them, and might well have suffered disappointments no less bitter than my own. Like me, he was not that living contradiction in terms a, quote, born Buddhist. Born into a Hindu family, and educated and trained as an orthodox Hindu scholar and ascetic, he had embraced Buddhism out of personal conviction, and his entry into a monastic order as formalistic and spiritually moribund as that of Theravada in Ceylon must inevitably have been followed by a period of disappointment. If that was the case, and if Kashyapji himself really had suffered the equivalent of being thrown out of the Dharmodaya Vihara, it was understandable that the subject of disharmony in the Sangha should be quite a painful one for him, and one that he was not willing to discuss. This would account for the peremptory manner, so unusual for him, in which he had stopped me unburdening myself to him, and for his refusal to allow me to talk about Aniruddha's misdeeds. Having long ago made up his mind that there was no such thing as a Buddhist spiritual community, he would naturally see no point in listening to complaints that assumed that there was, and no point, therefore, in giving me any other advice than he had already done. Despite his apparent failure to understand the emotional shock I had experienced, Kashyapji was, I knew, deeply concerned for my welfare. And if he had exhorted me to forgive and forget, it must have been because he genuinely believed that, in the circumstances, it was the best thing for me to do. Having come to this conclusion, I felt much easier in my mind. And by the time the Land Rover crossed Teesta Bridge and started on the steep climb that constituted the last stage of the journey, the keenness of the second disappointment I had suffered in Gangtok had begun to abate. Once back at Burma Raja's guest's cottage, and within sound of the reassuring tinkle of the wind bells, it did not take me long to pick up the threads of my various activities. Since I had completed most of the arrangements for the reception of the sacred relics before my departure for Gangtok, I did not have to make my way up to the bazaar or up to Siapai on quite so many mornings as before. What with the running of the YMBA and the bringing out of the next issue of Stepping Stones, there was, however, quite enough work to keep me busy, especially as the next issue of our monthly journal of Himalayan religion, culture and education was to be a special Sikh hymn number. The longest and most important article in this Sikh hymn number, which also contained contributions by Lama Govinda, Dr. Gunter, and Dr. Nebetsky de Wokowicz, was Thubten Tenzin's article on Sikkim Buddhism today and tomorrow. Since Thubten Tenzin was an extremely scrupulous and conscientious person and something of a perfectionist, the writing of this article gave him and me quite a lot of trouble. There was much discussion and many anxious consultations before it was at last finished. And even when it had been given to the printer and was going through the press, the author continued to make extensive alterations and additions. So lengthy did his article, in fact, become that the Sikkim number grew to twice the size of an ordinary issue, thus doubling our printer's bill for the month. With his usual generosity, Thubten Tenzin came to the rescue with a cheque to cover the difference. By this time, the sacred relics had returned to Gangtok, and the delegation was taking a short rest before setting out for Kalimpong. They were expected to arrive towards the end of March. After calling a final meeting of the reception committee, I therefore went round making quite sure that all our preparations were in order and that the reception would go off without a hitch. While I was thus engaged, I received news of a very disturbing nature. The procession in which the sacred relics were to be taken on their arrival in Kalimpong was to start at Eighth Mile, where there was a straight stretch of road, pass through the town via the High Street, and then proceed past the Church of Scotland Mission up to Tirpai and the Tapa Choling Gompa. This meant that it would have to pass in front of the Dharmodya Vihara, or rather, in front of the acclivity that led to those now deserted premises. The news I had received was to the effect that a group of Newars were planning to station themselves at the foot of the acclivity, with the idea that, when the palanquin containing the sacred relics drew abreast, they would seize hold of it and forcibly divert the procession to the Dharmodya Vihara. Greatly alarmed, I at once went to see the long-lived Deva. But my irascible friend only told me I was worrying unnecessarily and scornfully pooh-poohed the notion that the weak and cowardly Newars, as he termed them, would dare to divert the procession in this way. Despite his assurances, I was not completely convinced that the attempt would not be made, and eventually persuaded him to accept the responsibility of walking in front of the procession and making sure that it kept to the appointed route. Perhaps I should also arrange for a few policemen to be stationed at the foot of the acclivity leading to the Dharmodya Vihara. But such a precaution the long-lived Deva roundly declared to be quite unnecessary. And when I asked him what he would do if the Newars did, in fact, seize hold of the palanquin, he only stabbed himself in the chest with his forefinger, and lapsing into Tibetan, he roared, "Niga Pompa Re, I am the boss." With him in charge, his words clearly implied, no one would dare to seize hold of anything. It was therefore with a comparatively light heart that, two or three mornings later, I drove down to Teesta Bridge to meet the jeep in which Sangharatana and the rest of the delegation were bringing the sacred relics from Gangtok. Before leaving, I made sure that the procession was drawn up in proper order on the left-hand side of the road at Eighth Mile, and as I got into my car, I had the satisfaction of seeing the long-lived Deva marching up and down and making sure that nobody moved from his place. An hour or so later, I returned with the sacred relics, which were immediately transferred from the decorated jeep in which they had travelled from Gangtok to the palanquin that would take them to the Tapa Choling Gompa. As soon as the jeep and the other vehicles had fallen into line behind the palanquin, I gave the order to start, and with a tremendous roar from the 12-foot-long Tibetan trumpets, the entire procession started moving slowly up the road. After more than 2 months of preparation, these sacred relics had actually arrived in Kalimpong, and our arrangements for receiving them appeared to be functioning like clockwork. Having done what I had to do and having nothing further to worry about, though the thought of possible disruption by the Nuas still lingered at the back of my mind, I was therefore content to sit back in the jeep with Sangharasana and Kashyapji and admire the beautiful spectacle of which we were a part. Since the procession was more than half a mile long, and since the road into the town was not only very steep but twisted round the hillside in a series of sharp bends, I could see large sections of it at a time. Right in front of the procession moved the tiny figure of the long-lived Deva, very upright and walking with a kind of military strut. Behind him, walking in single file, came a long line of red-robed Tibetan monks, about 50 in number, and mostly from the Tapa Choling Gompa. Some of the monks carried musical instruments, while about a dozen others bore aloft the multicoloured, many-flounced banners of victory, which had been spaced out in such a way as to produce the maximum effect. Immediately behind the monks and in front of our own jeep came the palanquin containing these sacred relics. This was bright yellow in colour and shaped like a Chinese-style pavilion, with curved roof and curled-up eaves. And it was borne on the shoulders of 8 stalwart Tibetans, who were relieved at intervals by 8 other stalwart Tibetans, so that the merit of carrying these sacred relics could be shared by as many people as possible. Behind us followed the vehicles that had accompanied these sacred relics from Gangtok, which were in turn followed by an ever-growing number of local people. The whole procession moved to the slow, heavy beat of an enormous Tibetan drum, while the almost continuous sound of the shrill, harsh gailings was punctuated from time to time by the prolonged roar of the 12-foot trumpets, the echoes of which reverberated from the hillside. After we had gone about a mile, I saw ahead, on the right-hand side of the road, the sheltered spot that Tibetan mule drivers sometimes used as a camping ground. Beyond this, I knew, was the Dharmodaya Vihara. But there was no sign of any trouble. Indeed, as we passed the Vihara, the light, quote, auspicious shower that had started when the sacred relics arrived from Gangtok suddenly stopped. The sun came out, and the dazzling white peaks of Mount Kanchenjunga were revealed looking down on the scene. As the procession turned left into the high street, the long-lived Deva still marching ahead, and the gailings and 12-foot trumpets making a tremendous racket, we found ourselves moving between the densely packed ranks of the cheerful and excited people that lined it on either side. Smiling faces looked down from the windows and balconies of the 2- and 3-storied buildings. On the steps in front of many of the shops stood braziers from which the smoke of burning juniper twigs drifted across the street in dense white clouds. Tuba-clad figures prostrated themselves in the path of the procession, while others, detaching themselves from the crowd, darted between the legs of the 8 stalwart Tibetans and passed underneath the palanquin to the other side, thus obtaining, as they believed, the blessing of these sacred relics, or at least good luck. By the time the procession had debouched from the high street into the more open road that led to 10th Mile, the crowd had thinned out considerably, and I could see the figure of Thubten Tenzing walking incense stick in hand beside the palanquin, the black tuba that he had donned for the occasion contrasting strangely with the intense pallor of his face. On their arrival at the Tapa Choling Gompa, the sacred relics were received by the abbot, and, no doubt, by Rani Dorji. I had noticed that as we drew near to Tirpai, the monks carrying the 12-foot trumpets detached themselves from the procession and rushed on ahead. As we entered the Gompa, there they were, inside the gate, blowing, for all their worth, on their prodigious instruments, the mouthpieces of which rested on the shoulders of red-robed novices. During the 4 days that the sacred relics remained in Kalimpong, the delegation and I were kept busy in much the same way that we had been in Gangtok. In the morning and afternoon, the sacred relics were exposed for worship in the Lakang, or Temple of the Gompa, which, though darker and gloomier and dustier than the palace temple in Gangtok, was somehow a more impressive place, with a more intensely vibrant atmosphere. That was due, no doubt, to the fact that it was used more frequently and by a greater number of people. As in Gangtok, Sangharatana and I had to bump hundreds of heads each day, as well as clear away thousands of katas, or white ceremonial scarves. In fact, there were more heads to be bumped and more katas to be cleared away than there had been in Gangtok, as well as more money to be collected by Gayan Jyoti. Both Sangharatana and Dr. Soft remarked on the fact that whereas the Indians who came to pay their respects to the sacred relics offered only the smallest coins, the Tibetans always offered currency notes. Was this because the Indians were poorer or because the Tibetans were more devout? It was difficult to say which was the case, but I knew that the Tibetans regarded the Indians, that is, the modern Hindus, as very irreligious, an opinion which, had they known of it, would have shocked the latter greatly. Again, as in Gangtok, Sangharatana and Dr. Soft had told me how they had accompanied the sacred relics to Ladakh and Burma, so now they told me about their experiences with the sacred relics in Tibet. Kashyap G had either left Kalimpong early or was away most of the time. Both of them had received a stronger impression than ever of the faith and devotion of the Tibetan Buddhists, an impression that was being still further reinforced in Kalimpong. They also spoke in the most glowing terms of the 15-year-old Dalai Lama, whose appearance Dr. Soft described as charming and energy personified. The Dalai Lama had not only received the sacred relics on their arrival at the Donkara Gompa, but after they had been exposed for 4 days for the veneration of the public, he had preached in their presence a sermon, as Dr. Soft called it, that had lasted 3 days, and at the end of which he had personally blessed every one of the thousands of people present by touching them on the head with a golden jar. So interesting were the reminiscences of my two friends that I asked Dr. Soft to write an article about the sacred relics visit to Tibet for the Vaishakha number of Stepping Stones. This he did after he had returned to Calcutta, and the article appeared in our little magazine 2 months later. Meanwhile, colour pictures of the Dalai Lama receiving these sacred relics on the steps of Donkara Gompa had appeared in the American Life magazine and were seen by millions of people. In the evening there were no discourses as there had been in Gangtok. I had delivered a public lecture on Shariputra and Modgalyayana at the Hillview Hotel a few months earlier. Instead, the sacred relics were taken on short visits to the Bhutanese Gompa and the Dharmadaya Vihara, as well as to the houses of some of the more prominent Buddhist families of the town. The Bhutanese Gompa was a small building situated amid pine trees a short distance beyond the 10th mile. I'd visited it several times since my arrival in Kalimpong, but had always found it locked. Nothing ever seemed to happen there, and no one seemed to live there except a couple of caretakers, who might have been either monks or laymen, and who were in any case not usually to be seen. Thus, when Sangharatana, Dr. Soft and I accompanied the sacred relics to the Bhutanese Gompa, it was the first time I had seen the place open and the first time I had been able to enter. Within, the general layout was much the same as that of the Lakang at the Thapa Choling Gompa, and we had the satisfaction of exposing the sacred relics for the veneration of 100 or so crop-headed Bhutanese Buddhists, all barefoot and all wearing baggy striped chubas, which in the case of the men were kilted to the knee. At the Dharmadaya Vihara, we performed a similar service for the more excitable white-clad Niwas. It was the first time I'd been there since Burma Raja had whisked me away in his taxi 3 months earlier. Quite a number of the Niwas were plainly glad to see me again, and, despite Aniruddha's scowls, came and paid their respects to me in the usual manner. Some of my friends had been of the opinion that in view of the way in which Aniruddha had shut down the activities of the YMBA and thrown me out of the Dharmadaya Vihara, it could no longer be regarded as a Buddhist centre, and it would not be fitting for the sacred relics to be taken there. With this, I did not agree. Though Aniruddha had certainly behaved badly, many of the Niwas were not at all happy with his conduct, and it did not seem fair that they should be penalised on his account. When I saw the smiles with which many of them greeted me on my reappearance at the Vihara, I was more than ever convinced that in allowing the sacred relics to visit the Dharmadaya Vihara, I had done the right thing. The private houses to which the sacred relics were taken were situated quite far apart. Thus, Sangharatana and I found ourselves chanting the refuges and precepts and opening the two reliquaries in the coldly magnificent chapel of Bhutan House at 12th Mile, in the very new Tibetan-style shrine room of the Jyoti Brothers' very new house at 11th Mile, and in the sitting room of Mrs. Rose Sundup's flat on the third floor of Chung Building, the tallest building in the High Street. Who Mrs. Rose Sundup was, I did not know. In fact, I had not heard of her before, but Sangharatana assured me that she was a staunch supporter of the Mahabodhi Society, as her father had been before her, and that it was only right and proper that the sacred relics should be taken to the home of such a distinguished devotee. The distinguished devotee turned out to be a small, plump Tibetan woman in her early 40s, apparently Darjeeling-born, with an ingratiating manner and a rather winning smile, who sat on her haunches in front of the sacred relics, with a dazed expression on her face, as if hardly able to credit her good fortune, while her friends and neighbours came and made offerings. Not long after the sacred relics had left Kalimpong, I discovered that, in the estimation of the public, Mrs. Rose Sundup was not quite such a distinguished devotee as I had been led to believe. Indeed, the fact that the sacred relics, which had been considered too pure to be kept in the polluted atmosphere of the town hall, should have been taken to the home of a woman like Mrs. Sundup, occasioned a good deal of surprise. Sangharatana and I also chanted the refuges and precepts and opened the two reliquaries in the Burmese princess's tiny shrine room at Panorama. Knowing that Burma Raja dearly wanted to see and worship the sacred relics, but that the proud old man hesitated to invite them on account of his inability to make what he considered to be the proper offerings, with Sangharatana's consent, I told him that we would bring the sacred relics to Panorama after dark, and that we would not bring anyone else with us. Burma Raja and the princess thus had the satisfaction of having the sacred relics entirely to themselves for an hour. While they were busy worshipping them in evident fullness of heart, I took Sangharatana down to the guest cottage and gave him something to eat. By this time I knew that the Mahabodhi Society bhikshus at Sarnath all ate at night, and that one of the reasons they had kept Buddha Achyuta and myself so very much at arm's length 2 years earlier was that they were afraid we might find this out. Sangharatana, however, no longer made any secret of his post-meridional repasts. Indeed, he considered them perfectly justified. With his weak stomach, so he'd confided to me in Gangtok, and only half his liver in working order, it was quite impossible for him to eat before noon a sufficient quantity of food to sustain him throughout the day. All the same, he had quickly added, it was better not to let the laity know what one was doing. Some lay people found it difficult to understand such things, and it was important to keep up their faith in the Bhikshu Sangha. At the guest cottage, however, there was no need for him to bother about matters of this sort, and Venerable Sangharatana therefore tucked into the omelette Gopal eventually cooked for him with a clear conscience. When he had finished, we made our way back to Panorama and prepared to take the sacred relics back to the Thapa Chöling Gompa. I was touched to see that during our absence, Burma Raja and the princess had placed in front of the reliquaries, by way of an offering, 30 rupees in currency notes and some packets of gold leaf. 30 rupees, compared with the 300 rupees that Mrs. Sundup had given, and the larger amounts offered by Rani Dorji and the Jyoti brothers, it was a pitifully small sum. But knowing Burma Raja's proud and generous spirit, I was well aware that it probably represented all the ready money that he and the princess had in the house at the time. Had he received the sacred relics as King of Burma, as might well have been the case, there was no doubt that he would have been happy to offer 30 lakhs of rupees. It was a sobering thought, and one that I could not help sharing with Sangharatana after we had deposited the sacred relics on their throne in the lakhang of the Thapa Chöling Gompa, and were walking through the monastery orange grove towards a small stone building in which the delegation had been accommodated and where I too was staying. Indeed, I was anxious that Sangharatana should understand Burma Raja's position and not think that he was lacking in generosity. But I need not have worried. My warm-hearted friend knew from his own experience that the Burmese were hardly less generous than the Tibetans. And in any case, he had seen enough of Burma Raja, even in the course of a short visit, to know what sort of man he really was. By the time we reached the steps leading up to the back entrance of the building, therefore, Sangharatana had assured me that he fully understood Burma Raja's position, and that, having met him and the princess, he was more glad than ever that we had taken the sacred relics to Panorama. Though I did not know it at the time, the building in which the delegation had been accommodated had in fact been, and in a sense still was, the private residence of the celebrated Tomo Geshe Rinpoche, who, besides being the virtual founder of the Thapa Chöling Gompa, was also the founder of the Dongkara Gompa in the Chumbi Valley, where the Dalai Lama was now staying. Though the Rinpoche had been dead for many years, his was still a name to conjure with, not only in southern Tibet, but throughout the entire Himalayan region. Many people in the Darjeeling district still remembered him, and many were the stories that were told about his learning, his asceticism, and above all, his extraordinary, miraculous powers. There was an image of him in the bottom left-hand corner of the glass-fronted showcase that occupied the entire back wall of the lakhang, in which the sacred relics were being kept. There was also, just above the image, a photograph of his naked, embalmed body sitting erect and cross-legged. It was difficult to tell, either from the image or the photograph, what Tomo Geshe Rinpoche had really looked like, but there was no mistaking the fact that the broadly grinning face in the photograph, at least, was that of an exceptionally strong and determined personality. 2 days after Sangharatana and I had taken the sacred relics to Panorama, their visit to Kalimpong came to an end. It was now the people of Darjeeling's turn to give them a reception, and, as originally planned, I accompanied the delegates to the Queen of Hill Stations in order to help them look after the sacred relics there too. Once again, therefore, I saw the sacred relics taken in procession, though in a far less orderly fashion than in Kalimpong. Once again, Sangharatana and I bumped heads and cleared away white ceremonial scarves, this time in the small shrine room that occupied the top floor of the Tamang Gompa, as the Nyingmapa temple in the centre of the bazaar was popularly known. This shrine room was dedicated to Amitabha, the Buddha of Infinite Light, just as the big shrine room on the ground floor was dedicated to the great Guru Padmasambhava, and the medium-sized one on the middle floor to the 11-headed and 1,000-armed form of Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of Compassion. It was the first time I'd been on the second and third floors of the temple, and the first time I'd seen this particular arrangement of images. According to Nyingmapa tradition, Padmasambhava represented the Nyamanakaya, or created body of the Buddha. Avalokiteshvara, his Sambhogakaya, or body of glory. And Amitabha, his Dharmakaya, or body of absolute reality. Thus, the whole pagoda-type temple, with its shrine rooms on three floors and its three principal images, was in fact a three-dimensional representation of the Trikaya, or triple body of the Buddha, the same triple body that, in the form of body, speech and mind, was potentially present in every human being. Having parted from Sangharatana and Dr. Soft for the second time in little more than a month, I again crossed Teesta Bridge and again felt the Land Rover swaying from side to side as we climbed up through the clouds to Kalimpong. I was well content with the week's work, so content indeed that the disappointments I'd experienced in Gangtok now hardly seemed to matter. As a result of organising the reception of these sacred relics, I knew myself better than I had done 3 months ago, and had a better understanding of my capabilities. It also seemed likely that the visit of the sacred relics had given Buddhism in Kalimpong the kind of boost it so badly needed, and that the work of the YMBA had been made correspondingly easier. If this was indeed the case, there was no time to be lost. Our various social, cultural and religious activities would have to be carried on more vigorously than ever and expanded in as many directions as possible. Contacts I had made through my work as General Secretary of the Reception Committee would have to be followed up and more members and supporters enlisted. Above all, perhaps, we would have to start looking for more suitable premises from which to operate. End of chapter 11.